Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 15th of September. Not that we don't talk about politics many other days of the week, but as we get pretty darn close now to the presidential election, this is all things political, and we're going to be talking about a number of issues today. I think we should start. We don't know what will happen completely, of course, on Wall Street today, but I think that we should begin with what is happening this morning with the Dow down so much and Wall Street, as one press report said, waking up today with two of its storied firms having fallen. How does this play politically? We will talk about that. The poll numbers are extremely close right now. McCain's numbers have been going up over the weekend and actually since the Republican National Convention. What is the reason behind the rise in those poll numbers? Presidential debates are coming up. What would you like to hear discussed for those presidential debates? And whatever else you want to talk about concerning politics, and I'm sure I've spent the weekend talking a lot of politics, that you'll have much on your mind as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to use the email, you can do that. That is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org, if you want to get a hold of us that way. Professor David Jackson is our guest. He is from the Department of Political Science at Bowling Green State University. Major research interest is the relationship between entertainment and politics, specifically the connections between media use habits and political beliefs among the English-speaking young adult populations of the United States and Canada. Other research includes organized labor's political activity in the United States and U.S. trade policy. He's the author of Entertainment and Politics, The Influence of Pop Culture in Young Adult Political Socialization, and joins us by phone today. Wow, our phone lines are going already. You guys are ready to talk about politics. Professor David Jackson, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me back.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. Let's start. We don't know what's going to happen on Wall Street today, but let's talk about the economy here for a moment, because the news is not very good and it's having ramifications all around the world. The obvious question is, how does this play politically? Is this something that the Democrats can say is the Republicans' fault, or is it not a political discussion at all?
Well, there's two different ways I think that this is important politically, especially from looking at Obama's perspective, let's say. Number one is it changes the subject from Sarah Palin.
Right.
And anything that does that, I think, is a good thing for Obama. Now, if it had been, say, an international crisis, that would have been probably a benefit for John McCain. But since it's more evidence of what could be, you know, a serious economic meltdown in the United States, theoretically, you know, that should go to the Democrats' favor. If this election is about the economy, I'm of the opinion the Democrats win.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that it is the beginning, from all indications? I know you're not an economist, but you're a political scientist. That it is the beginning of a serious economic meltdown.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but it certainly shows that there's a lot that we don't know right now about how deep the housing crisis and the bad loans that are out there go, how the companies that made them don't know how much they're on the hook for. And as they're discovering it, I guess they're finding they don't have the capital to cover it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then it goes to the question of sort of bailouts, too, you know, looking for the federal government to come in and give an assist. Where we're here up in northern Ohio and not far from Michigan, we've also got the big three automakers now asking the federal government not for a bailout but for a low-interest loan. I think it helps their case if the federal government bails out Lehman Brothers. So, the depth of this thing is really unclear right now, but it doesn't look good.
Yeah. Does the government have enough money to bail out anybody?
Well, that's the thing. The federal government has a record deficit this year of like $480 billion. So whatever money they find, right, is certainly, one could argue, is just coming out of, you know, future taxes and future debt. The federal government bailing folks out seems kind of odd when the federal government is so massively in debt too.
Mm-hmm. You know, what's striking to me is, and tell me if I'm off base with this, it seems as though whatever the issue is of the day, that it becomes the issue that's going to benefit either the Republicans or the Democrats or whoever the candidate is, and how much attention he or she gets is really reflected in the poll numbers. Are we going to get down to the week before or the day before the election, and whatever's happening in terms of hurricanes or Wall Street, that's going to decide an election that's been going on for 2 years?
Well, I mean, I sort of, compare it to a basketball game that the final score, because this one's going to be close, is, maybe 101 to 100. The kid that misses the free throw at the end of the game is the GOAT if they don't win. But nobody remembers that free throws were missed early in the game, too. So it might look like the events at the end are what decided, but we have to remember that the campaign has been, as you point out, going on for 2 years. And so, yeah, I don't think necessarily that, October surprises and the very last event will necessarily decide the election, unless the campaigns haven't done the things they need to do in terms of solidifying their base, persuading independents. It's not to say that events aren't important. Clearly they are. But the campaigns set the context for the meaning of those events, and the debates and other other aspects of the campaign are certainly just as important as late events are.
Mm-hmm. So, to what do you attribute the phenomenal closeness of this race? This is a time when people are expressing great displeasure in government. They are not at all having favorable impressions of the past 8 years. Why aren't the Democrats walking away with this?
Yeah, it's really interesting. You've got 70 or 80% in the polls saying the country's going in the wrong direction. You've got the economy not exactly performing as well as people wanted to, although it might not officially be in a recession yet, with two consecutive quarters of negative economic growth. So you're absolutely right that the fundamentals certainly indicate that, the Democrats should, do very well in this election. And in the generic ballot, they do, right? When the question is asked, do you want a Democrat or Republican for president, Congress, Senate, they do better. But once the names are added, it becomes much more competitive. The Republicans nominated the best candidate from their field in terms of making this a competitive election. And frankly, the historical significance and fascinating nature of the Obama candidacy aside, the Democrats took a riskier choice, in a sense, by nominating somebody, who does in fact have less, experience, who is in fact African American, the first ever. And so we just don't know how that's going to play out. So, those are the reasons why I think it's close. I mean, I hate to say the race is going to be a factor, but I think it probably is.
Mm-hmm. It does, and I don't usually complain about the press because I think that most people are pretty hardworking and it's an honorable profession. But it does strike me that a lot of the press now has been so centered, and I refuse to do that this hour, on Sarah Palin, that it's just she has dominated the news for day after day after day after day, and we are really in a presidential race right now. Why are they so fixated on this story?
Well, I think, there's something interesting about that in that I think now some Obama supporters get a sense of how Hillary's supporters felt when he came along and just sucked all the oxygen out of the room because he was so novel and so interesting and so different than what we've seen before. Now you see the frustration on the Obama campaign side with the just massive media attention for Sarah Palin because she's unlike anything we've ever seen before. I mean, there's only ever been one woman nominated for vice president, and that was by Walter Mondale in the context of an election he probably wasn't going to win. This choice for most people came out of left field. Her background and biography are unlike the backgrounds and biographies of most people we see in national politics.
Right.
But the sense of the press is, I think, probably playing catch-up and spending a lot of time just explaining to themselves and then at the same time to the public who this candidate is.
So we're entertained by this?
Absolutely. To make an entertainment reference, Tina Fey on Saturday Night Live's impression was so good that the Sunday shows had to say that this is not really Sarah Palin, which is pretty darn impressive. But yeah, it's phenomenally interesting. I mean, and Obama was interesting in exactly the same way. And now, you know, we like the new, fresh face. And you know, to whatever extent there is a media bias, and I don't think it's a liberal or conservative bias, you know, the national media need a close election and need conflict. Now, I'm not saying that this necessarily skews consciously the presentation of material, but certainly the fact that Sarah Palin has, by most evidence, made this election closer makes it more interesting for the media. And
right.
In fact, frankly, of course, they're driven by audiences, too, and they know their audiences want to find out more about who this person is because she's like a whole lot of their audience, and that type is not one that we see a lot on the national
stage. No, that's for sure. Well, one final question from me about her, and then we'll go to phone calls. I was interested in, I'm just wondering if you agree with this or not, James Fallows had an interesting piece on theatlantic.com over the weekend in which he said he was very concerned about her answer to the Bush Doctrine. He's in China right now, so it's the only part of the recent interview that he's seen over in China. But he said in his piece that he believes that it implies a disqualifying lack of preparation for the job. He talks about people who follow sports talk radio or people who follow other kinds of topics, and those are topics that you know, he cares about. He cares about politics. So the fact that she was not interested enough in world affairs to become minimally conversant with the issues, he said, really troubled him. And I know that it has troubled at least, I don't know what percentage of the electorate, but at least a lot of the Democrats are concerned about that. What do you think?
Well, the Bush Doctrine is something that I think is fairly clear to people who follow politics and especially foreign policy. You know, it has been pointed out that the Bush Doctrine consists of a number of elements, and so her question about clarification could have been a question indicating that she wasn't sure which element of the Bush Doctrine Charlie Gibson was talking about. But I've seen the interview, and I think it was pretty clear. She really didn't know what he was talking about and was stalling to get some clarification so that she could give a fairly safe, talking point type answer. So, you know, without being, you know, too sort of, you know, partisan, it wasn't a very impressive performance in response to that question. On the other hand, it probably wasn't, you know, a substantial enough gaffe to capture a lot of media attention and cause people to say, well, she shouldn't have the nomination for vice president. So it was a mistake. It was an error. It certainly showed under preparation for the position, despite spending a lot of time, I think, with McCain advisors, you know, studying and preparing. But I don't think it was a, you know, as they say, game-changing gap.
And Obama, do you think that a lot of Democrats are concerned he just hasn't been tough enough, that he needs to, the issue that really is of concern and will be more so after today because people will be more jittery, is the economy, and that he needs to get on the trail and really come up with a very defined plan, but give it to us on television in a way that's simple for us to understand. But he needs to pound on something and do it with a great deal of force, or he's in trouble.
Well, I think what he needs to do, a colleague of mine actually made this argument, so credit where credit's due, but Bill Clinton at the Republican convention said a couple of times that the last 8 years are what conservative government looks like. And if the Democrats want to make this election into a realigning election, an election that actually, you know, changes for a generation, you know, control over the presidency and Congress, it has to be, you know, not just a referendum on the Bush administration, but a referendum on the policies that were pursued by the Bush administration economically, you know, in terms of deregulation, taxation. And so far that hasn't been done in sort of the clear, you know, two or three point way, you know, let's say President Reagan did in 1980. You know, you knew what he was going to do, whether you liked it or not. And I think you're right. I think it would be wise for Obama to sort of have the, you know, three-point plan, as it were, which he has. I mean, both of these candidates obviously have, you know, massive amounts of information on their websites and clear, you know, plans for what they're going to be pursuing, but it has to be presented in a pretty digestible way, which I think he does on the stump, by the way. I think his when the sound bites are played from Obama's stump speeches, they are very clear, and they do sound empathetic. And like he does understand, you know, the American people, but it's a fairly, you know, inefficient way, sort of going town to town, speech to speech. But that's what the debate will do, give both candidates that opportunity to sell it.
We're going to take phone calls. Our guest is Professor David Jackson, Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science at Bowling Green State University. And we're welcoming phone calls at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We'll also talk about the culture wars. It's interesting how some of the issues have changed here. Are we back to conversation about the culture wars in this presidential election? So our lines are all busy right now, but there'll be an opening eventually. And you can also send an email if you'd like to do that. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, Bob Schieffer will be with us. He's written a book. It's a series of essays, very thoughtful essays that have been a part of commentaries that he's done for a number of years. So he talks about all the presidents. He's interviewed all of them. He's started his career and really rose to some kind of prominence the day that John F. Kennedy was assassinated. He's been to Vietnam. He's going to be moderating one of the presidential debates, and his book is America, Bob Schieffer's America. He joins us, hour number two of our show today. Professor David Jackson here now, Associate Professor, Department of Political Science at Bowling Green State University. And we start our calls with Tom from Burlington. Hello.
Good morning. My father was a member of Congress. And Charles A. Vanek from Ohio, who you might be familiar with, he was a very good friend of my father's. And after my father died, Charlie and a whole bunch of other congressmen sort of took me under their wing, and they became my father. And I was a page in the Congress. But one thing I learned when I was there is that all these congressmen were lawyers, and they were passing all these bills and spending all this money. And I knew in my family that lawyers have many talents, but one talent they don't have is really for spending money. So when I went to school, I studied economics at Georgetown University at the School of Foreign Service because I was fascinated by money and how the American economy worked. But what I think now is that when the Bush administration started bailing out the banks, what we really have to do, and we have to establish confidence in the economy. And so once they should have continued bailing out Lehman Brothers. Do everything you possibly can to bail out the banks and the borrowers as well. It's very, very important that they do this. They didn't do this today, and we're going to suffer.
All right. How do we establish confidence in the economy, and can presidential candidates do that in the remaining weeks, Professor Jackson?
Well, again, not being an economist, I'd be, you know, getting right outside of my framework too much to say what I think it would take for establishing. I mean, I don't think confidence is gone in a broad sense from the U.S. economy. I mean, there was talk of the euro becoming the currency of choice globally, but I think the dollar is still, you know, maintaining that position. I don't think, you know, the entire, you know, system is on the verge of collapse or anything like that. So confidence in the broadest sense of the term, I don't think is absent. Now, certainly, at the, you know, public level, I think, you know, people's confidence in their own economic futures is very weakened right now. I mean, we see, you know, people thinking that, you know, their kids and themselves are not going to do as well as previous generations. And I think it's that lack of confidence that a candidate needs to tap into with a solution in order to, you know, to win this election. So from the political perspective, I would talk about confidence that way.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the most I should say about that without saying something wrong.
Well, what about these culture war issues that seem as though we kind of got past those, but here they are again: abortion, books in libraries, the role of religion in government, guns, etc. Are those going to be major elements in this campaign? Is there another culture war going on, and who's in it?
Yeah, obviously, I guess not obviously, but certainly since the Palin choice, these issues have come back, and there are some significant cultural differences in the United States. You know, what we used to call the culture wars, I think, are absolutely back again. And I was thinking about this before we went on the air, and thinking about it from Obama's perspective, and the idea that he's being painted as, you know, out of touch, elite, you know, sort of, you know, different from normal Americans. You know, the same way that John Kerry, to a great degree, and maybe to a lesser degree, Al Gore were painted. And I wonder if it wouldn't be good for those candidates to say something to the effect of, maybe I'm not the guy you want to go out with for a beer. You know, maybe I'm not the guy who's going to go hunting or fishing with you, you know, unlike what Kerry chose to do, going duck hunting and looking almost Dukakis-like in the tank doing it. Just admitting that, you know, maybe we are different in terms of our background, but I've got some policies that I think, you know, will work to make your life better. So not ignoring the cultural distinctions, the culture wars issues, but, you know, almost sort of using them to, you know, relink back to, you know, bread and butter economic issues where I think the Democrats, you know, do better. So
right.
If I were giving advice to Obama, that's what I would say about these culture wars issues. Yeah, we're not the same guy, but... You know, that's not such a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to go have a beer with McCain either.
Right. Let's go to Dave from Menominee. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. John McCain is pulling a thing now. He's coming out and saying some things that reminded me of a kid that I grew up with. Whenever we'd play a game, we'd get together, and there was always this one kid on our block that would kind of force his way into the game. Nobody wanted him around, really. He was kind of a bully. And he would change rules. He would try to say, let's do it this way. Nobody would agree. If anybody would come up and say, you know, had the backbone to say, we're not going to do that, sometime during the game, you'd end up getting a punch or something, a spoke kicked out of your bike tire or something. And his reply was, if you'd gone my way, you wouldn't have had to deal with that. And when John McCain has come out now and says, if Barack Obama would have just gone along with these town meetings, he wouldn't have to deal with this stuff, all these nasty, rotten ads that are on. And when he said that, it brought me right back to when I was 12, you know, getting punched by a guy that I said, you know, that isn't the rules, you know. And I just wanted to get your guest's comment on, you know, what is happening with these campaigns and why we as a society deal with this stuff when Europe looks at us and they think it's just an absolute circus.
Professor Jackson.
Well, I wonder what would have happened if the kids in the playground had taken a swing back at that bad kid. But as far as the specific question about the town hall meetings, Obama, I think at the time he made the decision, it was the politically right decision to do. It's almost as if you go to, you know, the official playbook sort of on rules for how to run a campaign, and when you're ahead, even though he wasn't ahead that much, you don't do 10 debates with your opponent because it gives your opponent a ton of free media, and you've already opted out of the public finance system, so you expect that you can afford more paid media, so why do that for your opponent? Well, then the election becomes closer. And it's not just McCain, but some other, you know, some Democrats have said the same thing, that, you know, Obama probably regrets now not doing those town hall meetings because he could have, you know, had a response right away to the Sarah Palin nomination. And but it's just as equally possibly true that since the Obama campaign fumbled, I would say, the initial response to the Palin nomination, that had there been a nationally televised town hall discussion that you know, trumpeted that response, it would have been negative, you know, for the Obama campaign. So so in terms of that specific claim, you know, I don't think it was a terrible error, even now that the context has changed, for Obama not to agree to those 10 town halls. And as to the McCain, or to the caller's claim that McCain is saying, well, I wouldn't have hit you with all these negative commercials, I hadn't necessarily heard him say that, but I would bet, you know, dollars for donuts that those commercials would have run no matter what, you know, kind of debates the campaign, you know, campaigns had accepted. That's the current nature of American politics is negative campaign commercials. So that's my answer to that.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks very much for the call. Mike is next from Brookfield. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Professor Jackson. I was out canvassing over the weekend for Barack Obama, and it was interesting to me that there were people that were for McCain and people that were for Obama and people even that were for Nader, and of course people that were undecided, but that the number of people who identified very clearly as strongly for McCain or strongly for Obama, and that then that they far outweighed the number of people who were undecided, which is, at least from my anecdotal experience, this much prior to the election is pretty unusual. And I just kind of wanted to get your comment on that.
Yeah, my understanding is that in a really recent poll, I think the number was 5% undecided.
Oh, my.
It's a very low number. It doesn't leave a lot of room for persuasion. Now, that was one poll, and others may show, you know, almost certainly a higher percentage. But nonetheless, I mean, the number of undecideds is fairly low, which leads to another point that Chuck Todd, the political director on NBC, was making, which is, with more and more states having early voting, for example, I know we have that in Ohio, where I'm at. I'm not sure if Wisconsin does. But his suggestion was that where the polls sit on around October 15th is pretty much probably where it's going to be in those states because so many people have already voted. So it's weird. We have a campaign that goes on for 2 years, and then in the last 7 weeks, we might end up seeing it sort of end early, as it were.
Hmm.
But I don't know, you know, how serious a possibility that is, especially since Obama's campaign is counting on young voters in particular who are probably not likely to vote early.
So, right.
Although they're really trying hard to get them to vote early so that they don't forget
mm-hmm.
or don't, you know, make mistakes. So that's that.
Mm-hmm. I think Todd is quite good, don't you? I listen to him. There aren't a whole lot of people that you listen to, but I respect his work.
Yeah, he's so, and I use this term as a compliment, although some people don't. I think he's kind of professorial in the sense that he doesn't seem particularly biased.
Right.
He's really clear with the explanation mm-hmm. of data, and he's got obviously some of the best political, you know, public polling data at his fingertips. And offers what I think are usually pretty good insights. I like his work, too.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Mike, for the call. Scott from Green Bay. Hi.
Good morning. Yeah, I've been trying to figure out why the election seems to be so close. I guess earlier in the year, I would have thought Barack Obama would have walked away with it. And I guess this is just maybe my opinion. I think it might be so close because a couple of reasons. One, the economy isn't doing so well. But the Democrats have run the House and the Senate for the last 2 years and really have not done anything. There's not been anything that's benefited the economy. And I think they may be getting some of the blame because if you look at it, the disapproval rates for Congress are actually lower than George Bush's disapproval rates. That's one thing. And then the other thing that I'm thinking is the day Barack Obama decided to opt out of public financing when he said he was going to stay in the system, in my opinion, is the day he became just another politician. And if you listen to him earlier in the year and last year, he was much more, he was a different politician. He was fresh. He had different, unique, new ideas. And now you hear tax cuts for the rich, a tax break for big oil. He's morphed into this standard, typical Democrat candidate. There's nothing unique about him anymore. I mean, he had something. He had, you know, he gives a good speech, and that's really about his gift right now because there's nothing unique about him compared to any other Democrat candidate. And I think that's starting to come out, and I think that's why John McCain has picked up ground. And I point to the day he decided to opt out of public financing. I think he's just another one of the guys.
Professor Jackson.
Certainly. Think that on both the points, if we go back to his point about Democratic control of Congress and the Democrats having a lower approval rating than even President Bush, it's absolutely true. So the public has this sort of a pox on both your houses feeling going on and you know, want something postpartisan, which is what Obama represented at first. And I think the caller is right that he's, you know, taking a number of positions which can be described as, you know, political choices. He moved, you know, more to the center after the Democratic primaries were over, which is what candidates do when they start listening to consultants. On the other hand, it's only natural that a candidate who relied so heavily on his novelty and his newness and freshness is going to seem sort of, you know, older and staler as time goes by. So in a sense, you know, the length of this campaign is definitely working against Obama as he seems less and less fresh, just sort of naturally, just as you know, his time. time on the scene, you know, progresses, and he takes some positions that seem like he's moving toward the center and maybe listening to consultants the same way that Kerry did and Gore did. On the other hand, it should be pointed out, too, I think, in all fairness, but the Democrats would certainly argue, and I think there's some evidence to suggest that John McCain is a very different candidate now than he was in 2000, that, you know, his freewheeling days saying whatever came to his mind with the media are certainly gone. And I sort of was looking at, it's such a big deal in Michigan whether or not John McCain bought a Toyota car for his daughter. And he was hemming and hawing about it, and he was saying that he had or he hadn't, and then maybe that she bought it herself, I understand. I mean, that sort of discussion. Well, the old John McCain would have said, yeah, I did. So what? I bought the better car. If you guys make better cars, I'd buy one of those.
Hmm.
You know, so they all sort of get, you know, consultant eyes, you know,
right,
and lose, you know, some of their, you know, ease in terms of, you know, sort of connection with people.
Right.
I think the caller makes a very good couple of points.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. I don't think, though, that the American people are particularly clued into this public financing aspect. It's the same thing as campaign finance reform, which ruins the system. And, of course, people are beholden to those who give them money. And yet you've got a small part of the American public that's outraged by this. I don't think too many other people are clued into it.
I think you're right. I didn't comment on that part. Yeah, I don't think there's even, you know, survey evidence that suggests that. I think that maybe particularly politically tuned in people might notice it. And the campaign, the public finance system was not, you know, exactly a total public financing system anyway. So opting out of it isn't like he was opting out of, you know, total public financing. It just, you know, limited him after the primaries to, you know, a whole lot of money. If you look at a system like, say, Canada's, which is, you know, very different from ours. Each party gets basically, I think, $1.50 in the current election from the government for every vote they got in the previous election. And there's pretty much no other contributions. Now, that's public finance.
Yeah, so what a difference. What
yeah.
a difference. Woo. Thanks for the call. Let's go next to Jan from Sauk City. Hi, Jan.
Thank you for taking my call. I hope that during the debates that they concentrate on the economy, because if they concentrate on the economy and you compare the two, I think it's going to show that McCain is really out of touch. And I think that it will also bring out the lies. McCain is talking that Barack Obama wants to raise our taxes. I'm in my middle 60s. And if the economy stays like it is, I will probably never be able to retire. And the last comment I have is, if McCain were elected and something happened to him, and the very thought of Sarah Palin become president terrifies me, because I think she will do more damage to women's rights. I think we will be put back in the dark ages, so to speak. I think Roe versus Wade will end up getting overturned, and there still will be abortion, but there'll be back alley abortions. So that's my comment, and I would like to know what your guest thinks of that.
All right, Jan, thanks for the call. David.
Well, as to the question of Sarah Palin becoming president, you know, there is some possibility of that happening. And if, you know, McCain wins, because not to be ghoulish, but, you know, he's 72 and has had a rough life, had cancer. But I don't think it would be Sarah Palin necessarily who's just alone on the ticket in favor of changing, you know, Supreme Court and constitutional doctrine on the question of Roe versus Wade. McCain has said very clearly that he believes it was a bad decision, and he said very clearly that Scalia and Roberts are the sorts of justices that he would appoint. So it's no mystery there from the campaign, and it doesn't take, you know, Sarah Palin to figure out what, you know, kind of Supreme Court justices, you know, are going to come from the two different campaigns. As to the economy, I think the caller is, again, absolutely right. The Democrats should do better, should frankly win the election if the focus is on the economy, and if they can sound like they have some, you know, better idea, you know, what to do about it. And I think it will become about the economy. The caller mentioned the debates. I think the first one has a focus on foreign policy. So it probably won't happen there unless the campaign sort of link, you know, the growing federal debt to, you know, foreign government owning that debt and issues like that. certainly in the second and third debate, the focus should shift more to the economy.
Yeah, we're interviewing Schaefer, Bob Schaefer, the second hour, and the word we have is domestic and economic policy will be the focus of that debate. So, October 15th.
Gotcha.
So we'll question him about that. thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Andrea from Menominee. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I wanted to, first of all, thank the guest for making a comment that to me is just so key. This desire that we have to have in a president someone we can sit down and have a beer with. You coined the exact thing that had been going through my head since the show in the previous hour when someone called in and said, you know, I mean, he was beautifully open about what he said, which is, I'm uncomfortable with Barack Obama because he seems sort of too smart. You know, like he thinks too hard about things. And what came to me is, you know, I'm working hard to be involved in politics and be more aware this election probably than I ever have been. I've always voted, but truly being educated about what people stand for. And I realized that no amount of effort on my part is going to give me a fullness of understanding about domestic and international policies. And what I want in a president is someone who I think not only has the intellectual capacity, but also has the flexibility to sit down with people from a whole variety of backgrounds, both, you know, the real Americans from backgrounds of a variety of lives, but also people in the political realm, people who are saying, this is what you need to know about, you know, this part of the world, et cetera. And I really think Barack Obama has a unique both intellect and then that kind of wisdom and strength of character to really allow other people to open up and communicate with him and to take that in and integrate it and do something that I could at least then respect. It's just been making me kind of terrified, as the previous caller said, when I heard, I watched the whole Republican convention, and when I heard Palin's speech that to me was so filled with kind of blinders on, us versus them, you're either like me or you're not kind of attitudes, it was very frightening. So my question, I guess, is I think you said it brilliantly. We need to somehow allow ourselves to be interested in a president that isn't exactly like us. If you look at the variety of us in America, you know, how would that work anyway? What we need is a person, a strength of character, wisdom, experience, certainly, in tackling ideas. How do we get Americans to see that? You know, we who are caught up in reality TV, how do we go there?
Well, first of all, thanks for the kind words about what I said. And secondly, now not to necessarily contradict myself, but there is some logic to Americans looking at a presidential candidate and saying, well, you know, what does this person represent? Because, you know, we know from political science that politicians do, in fact, try to keep their promises because they really want, you know, what they propose to become law. Now, does the public necessarily believe that? Well, maybe not. And so since they have, you know, suspicion and doubt about politicians' willingness to keep their promises, or perhaps more logically, their ability to keep promises, because there's just not going to be radical changes in the American system based on who becomes president. And totally radical changes in policy, unless, you know, certain, you know, windows of opportunity present themselves. So then the people look to what they can know, what they can, you know, sort of, you know, empirically, emotionally feel, and that is, you know, a sense of the character of the candidate. So because they can judge that, they do. And so the caller makes a really compelling case for Obama being the kind of character and intellect and sort of version of America that, you know, maybe even more reflective of who we really are now demographically. But Obama has to make that case too. So, and I don't think he's done a terribly good job of that, making, you know, that sort of, you know, emotional character connection with people.
Mm-hmm. Hey, people have worried that we're entering, again, there's always been an undercurrent of this, and I wonder if this is playing out and why it's playing out. This anti-science, global warming may not be man-made, the polar bears don't need to be part of an endangered species list, that without being too denigrating to her, but there is something rather strange about the vice presidential candidate saying that you can see Russia from an island in Alaska. There's something about it that is sort of anti-intellectual. And I know that's been a problem in American society for a long time, but it seems to me as though most of us would want our presidents to be pretty smart. don't we? And why wouldn't we?
Well, I mean, we want different, even potentially contradictory things simultaneously, right? I mean, we want somebody who is, you know, better than us, as it were, maybe intellectually, but at the same time, we don't want them to be some sort of, you know, egghead who's so different from us that they can't, you know, sympathize with us when things are going wrong. So it's a bizarre thing, and not bizarre, but and it's partly context-driven, too. I mean, because, you know, Jimmy Carter tried to be sort of an average American. Look how that failed him, right? You know, wearing sweaters and not having the band play Hail to the Chief every time he showed up. So he tried really hard, and I think he was, too, and is, sort of, you know, in some ways an average guy, despite the fact that he has almost a PhD in nuclear physics. And then Reagan came along and sort of got it both ways, right? He, you know, got the, you know, symbolic office of the presidency restored, and some people, overwhelming majorities, in fact, of people looked at him as being average and kind of like them.
Mm-hmm.
It's this, yeah, I think you're right that it makes sense, and we know it sometimes, that we want a president who's really, really smart. But sometimes, you know, I think quite appropriately, the public thinks really, really smart people don't care about them.
Huh. It's also so strange,
really,
isn't it?
They look at professors that way.
Let's welcome more phone calls in a moment. It's All Things Political this Monday at 9, as it always is. Professor David Jackson is our guest, associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Bowling Green State University. Our phone number, and we thank you, Andrea, for your call. One line is open right now, 800-486-8655. Emails are open at talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, Bob Schieffer will be with us, has been covering the news for more than half a century, starting at the Fort Worth Star-Telegram before joining CBS News in 1969. He has covered every president since then. He has been all over the world. He's been the anchor and moderator of Face the Nation, and he will be moderating the third presidential debate. So we're happy to have him with us after the news at 10 o'clock. Back to phone calls now for Professor David Anderson, and we go to Doug from Wauwatosa. Hi, Doug.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to make a comment about the Bush Doctrine and Sarah Palin's ability to understand that point. I mean, the Bush Doctrine was very clearly spelled out in the National Security Statement in 2002, and it's unconscionable to me that she would not know about this, because it's just such a huge mindset change. The biggest change that George Bush has instituted, and, you know, to have preventative war as a result, it's not even, to me, it's just unconscionable she would know about that. And I think back to what you're talking about, Kathleen, it seems to me just illogical that, you know, if people wanted to repair their computer, they'd want somebody who knows a little bit about computers, probably more than they do. And to me, it just seems as if it would be nice if our president knew essentially a little bit more than about politics and national policy and foreign policy than the average person does.
Professor Jackson.
Yeah, two things about that. One is I was definitely giving Governor Palin the benefit of the doubt on the Bush Doctrine, trying to be, you know, sort of fair and suggest that as... You know, George Will, who's obviously a big defender of her, and some others suggested, well, the Bush Doctrine means preemptive war. The Bush Doctrine also means that countries who have terrorists living in them should be treated as countries who are terrorist nations themselves and are worthy of being attacked. So the elements of the Bush Doctrine may have been what she was confused about. You know, personally, from seeing the interview, that's not how I saw it. She wasn't exactly sure what he was talking about, and so wanted clarification as a means to buy time to give an answer. So there's the benefit of the doubt argument, and there's the, you know, interpretation that says otherwise.
Right.
And certainly people are free to see it either way, and I, you know, admit that the way I saw it was not the benefit of the doubt way, but, you know, nonetheless, that's a possibility. And secondly, the computer comparison is interesting. I mean, and not to get, you know, too professorial here, but if we go back, you know, to Socrates and Plato, they suggested that politics is a skill that's learned like every other skill, and so that the political class, the ruling guardians, if you will, ought to be people who are educated in special ways for that special skill, just like, you know, other, you know, skills have to be taught to people. That idea is obviously still around. We'd call it the, you know, an elitist argument, but in a democracy, there's also the idea that the collective, you know, judgment of the people and is also correct. But what if the collective judgment of the masses of the people and the judgment of, you know, trained elites are, you know, in conflict, as they often are? Well, that's the democratic problem in a nutshell, if you ask me. And so the fact that the people, you know, have, you know, see things both ways, sometimes wanting an elite, sometimes wanting a common person, it makes sense in a democratic system that people would feel that way.
Yeah. And it seems
to
me,
it
seems to me from seeing her speak before her Alaska crowds that Sarah Palin's special skill is in making Alaska prosperous, that's where you see the sparkle in the eyes and this is what's happened here and giving money back to Alaskans, and that's where her focus has been. And you know, a lot of people disagree with some of the policies, but you can see the sparkle in her. She knows those kinds of issues, energy issues. No matter where you fall on them, that's her expertise.
Well, Michael Kinsley made a very interesting argument. His numbers are to be trusted. Essentially, what he claimed is that Alaska figures out how much it should cost the oil companies to extract a barrel of oil, and they set that around $25. And then they tax at an amazing rate the difference between that $25 and the going rate for oil.
Hmm.
Now, that's nearly, you know, confiscatory and certainly probably beyond anything Obama has you know, suggested in terms of a windfall profits tax, because it's built right in to the system. So I wouldn't say that, you know, almost anybody could make Alaska prosperous with $100 barrel of oil, but certainly it helps.
Right.
And that's a fairly narrow experience. And I think it's totally legitimate for the Democrats to critique Governor Palin on that narrowness of her experience in running a state that, you know, just isn't that, well, like the rest of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. There's a reason they call us the lower 48, right?
Yeah, that's it's not just geographical.
Yeah, exactly. George from Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I thought it was telling at the Republican National Convention that John McCain, the great reformer and maverick, did not feel comfortable in even mentioning two of his most maverick positions within his own party, that of campaign finance reform and a reasonable attempt at immigration reform. I think it showed me that you know, if he's not tough enough to even stand up to his supporters in mentioning these two kind of hallmarks of his maverickism, I wonder how separate he's going to be from them if he gets elected. How comfortable he'll feel wavering from his base.
Well, possibly not very. And what's interesting about you know, if you look at President Bush and John McCain, President Bush too supported immigration reform. Comes from Texas, and then you look at you know, the Arizona senator, John McCain, had the same position or did initially support immigration reform. And when he used to say things about the environment, he would talk about, you know, global warming being man-made. Their recognition of that is very impressive from a political perspective, because my impression is that the new generation of young voters are very environmentally concerned.
Mm-hmm.
The largest growing population in the United States is the Latino population. The party that captures those two groups is going to be the dominant party for a generation. And there's moments when you see with President Bush and McCain, just from pure political perspective, that they recognize that. But, you know, sort of the core of their party, the base of the party, might not. And, you know, leadership has to move the party. But on the other hand, there's also winning now. and that's the point of an election, not be it a primary election or a general. So he has to balance both of those.
Thanks, George. We have about 30 seconds, so we have to be quick here. Dan from White Lake.
I would just like to say that if Ms. Palin has an Achilles heel, although she's a nice person, it's her Assembly of God, young earth notion. She gets her science and knowledge from her minister, We've had one of these people in the White House for some time. That's why it's been such a disaster. As a short earth, somebody who takes the Bible literally and believes the earth is no more than 10,000 years old, that is the conscious choice of ignorance over knowledge and education. Nobody like that should be running the country.
David.
And to the caller, and there's no way meant to insult the caller, but there's absolutely no way that the Obama campaign should say anything exactly like that to the extent that it would offend somebody's religious beliefs. Certainly they can defend science, but a campaign, unlike a citizen, has to be very careful not to, to frame things in a way that sounds like they're attacking someone's personal religious beliefs.
David, thank you so much for being with us. It was a good hour. Thanks.
I love it. I love being on the show. This is fun.
Thanks. We'll have you again.
All right.
Thank you, Professor David Jackson. And he is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Bowling Green State University. We thank Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. And we thank Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. News ahead from National Public Radio. Please stay tuned. Bob Schieffer is with us the second hour of today's Monday program.